In our house, as we were headed into the heart of the Advent season this year, someone gave Corrine a book called Night Visions, Searching the Shadows of Advent and Christmas. It felt like a really lovely, honest, kind of heads-up piece of writing and art-making about a time of year when it sometimes seems like there's so much pressure to get it right, to kind of make happiness happen by dint of just like either trying our hardest or just spending enough money, doing whatever we have to do so somebody has that, oh, it's perfect moment, right? This book opens with a quote from someone named Jack Boozer. I felt sorry for Jack's childhood on the playground. I don't know anything about Jack, but I really like the quote. It said, he wrote this, "In this strange season, when we are suspended between realization and expectation, may we be found honest about the darkness, more perceptive of the light." May we be found honest about the darkness, more perceptive of the light. And when I read that a couple of weeks before Christmas, it felt like it had this really big impact on me. It felt like it sort of put into words a bunch of things that were rumbling around inside of me about that season. And it helped me to focus my part in our efforts as a community to mark that season in a way that was honest as well as hopeful. And I would have to say that that's a feeling that hasn't gone away for me. And I want to carry that into the new year. In our culture, there's this feeling post-Christmas, sort of a door that just slams shut and it makes everything Christmas disappear, you know? I was in a store that prides itself on having low prices recently, and the place looked like a bomb had gone off in it because they were, you know, putting Christmas behind that door. It was kind of remarkable. Physical experience of this reality. In older Christian tradition, this wasn't the case because what preceded Christmas was Advent. We've touched on that here in December. This sort of deliberate time of stopping and waiting that holds off the party until Christmas Eve. And then what follows Christmas in that tradition, where it's still practiced, it still does, is something called Christmastide. Christmastide ended this past Friday on January 5th with the celebration of something called Epiphany. So why am I talking about, you know, the ancient practice of things like Advent and Epiphany? Is it because the table is going to take some of these historic practices on in the new year? I'm going to kind of put that one to rest. That's not where I'm headed. There can be real value in a choice like that, but St. Benedict's Table is already doing a bang-up job of it, and they're just a few blocks away, and they meet in the evening, so if that's calling out to you in the, you know, 21st century church tradition, you can be part of more than one community and follow that season closely. I'm talking about it for two other reasons this morning. One is that I want to gently assail our inclination to have our spiritual practices dictated to us by the prevailing culture. Christmas, as it has historically existed in Christendom, is a rather vigorous celebration of the idea that God is in our midst, and that the home of the divine in that story is an ordinary young woman, that the household of the divine is a household where livings are made in ordinary ways, like the trades. It's a story in which the carriers of the homes of God are common folks that are subject to common things like surveys and taxes and military overthrows and being conflict refugees and seeking the presence of God in more than one religious practice. Those are all things that are part of the narrative that we call the Christmas story. Those are all things that don't stop being the case just because the staff at the mall are packing up one display and getting out another. Those common things that I mentioned, those aren't the sort of stories that only happen on one day of the year. So looking for the presence of God in the midst of those stories probably shouldn't get boxed up and delivered on only one day of the year either, at least not if we want to pursue the possibility that God might be present in every part of life. And the second reason I want to talk about this today is because the season of Christmastide ends in most historical practices with this ancient feast of Epiphany. And I don't want to make anything particular of this next piece of information. It's just kind of intriguing that this feast day, Epiphany, in Christian practice is quite a bit older than Christmas, which did not start, you know, with the birth of Jesus. but it's sort of been co-opted by Christmas. Typically, but not always, Epiphany is now focused on the story of the Magi dropping in to visit the child Jesus. And if you've been around here any length of time, you may recall that the Magi are some of my favorite characters in the Jesus story. I just like these characters because they don't belong to the religion that the story comes from. They don't belong to the culture that the story comes from. They didn't even show up until a couple of years after Jesus is born, but they get in on the whole story anyway. I think that's a good enough set of reasons right there to like the Magi. And when they do get in on the whole story, we use a word like epiphany to reference that event. And I think that's pretty fascinating. What's an epiphany? Well, the way we use the word, a couple of common definitions. An epiphany is a moment when you suddenly feel that you understand or suddenly become conscious of something that is very important to you. That's a pretty common use for the word epiphany. It also has sort of a more religious meaning, which just means a powerful religious experience. So in the context of the story of the Magi, that kind of makes sense, right? These are folks that have spent their whole life looking at the sky. And they're wondering what the whole thing means. This is a part of their, if not vocation, then avocation. It's part of their practice of life. And then they see something in the sky that makes them toss their lives into disarray by packing up and hitting the road. They are headed, when they hit the road, for who knows where. They are headed for who knows where for who knows how long. But apparently, they don't feel free to just abandon the quest and go back to how things were before. Whatever this is about, and it's not entirely clear what this is about, but whatever it's about, it's important to them. I don't know if you can relate to that. I don't know if that kind of set of descriptors feels like it's resonant with any of your own spiritual journeying. This sense of, I don't know where I'm headed. I'm not sure I'll be able to tell when I get there. And even if I do, I don't know what the impact might be. But I can't seem to stop moving, even when most of my experiences feel like I'm kind of stumbling around in the dark. And right about now, I could use an epiphany. Can we talk for a few minutes about the right about now part of that? When I listen to what seemed to be the loudest cultural voices at the turning of the year, I feel like I'm hearing a lot of, well, 2017 wasn't that great. So I'm hoping for a better 2018. That might even be on the mild side. I feel like I'm hearing a fair bit of 2017 was a disaster and 2018 it better not stay on that path or we're headed off a cliff. That zeitgeist shows up all over the place. Intriguingly, even in the houses of privilege and power. I want to read you a little bit of an excerpt from an interview that was conducted by Prince Harry, who knew, with the former American President Barack Obama recently. This is an interesting excerpt. Harry, I won't even attempt the accents. Can you give people a reason to feel optimistic about the year ahead, please? So that's the zeitgeist. That's what I was talking about. That's the defining mood of a period of history, which is what zeitgeist means. That's the tone of we could use an epiphany right about now. And I think Obama's answer is fascinating because he doesn't ignore or try to minimize the realities behind that feeling, but he also doesn't stay in that space. And this is a bit of an extended bit, but I want to read it to you because it holds in tension quite beautifully some difficult things. So this is his reply to Harry's, can you give people a reason to feel optimistic about the year ahead, please? Well, I don't think in terms of 1 year, but I can tell people what I genuinely believe. If we take responsibility for being involved in our own fate, if we participate, if we engage, if we speak out, if we work in our communities, if we volunteer, if we see the joy that comes from service to others, then all the problems that we face are solvable despite all the terrible news that we see, despite all the genuine cruelty, pain, and hardship that people are experiencing around the world at any given moment. If you had to choose a moment in human history in which you wanted to be born, and you didn't know at the time whether you were going to be Prince Harry or Barack Obama or a small child in rural Africa or India, you'd choose today, because the fact is the world is healthier, wealthier, better educated, more tolerant, more sophisticated, and less violent than just about any other time in human history. You think about the history of the United States. It was only a few generations ago when someone who looked like me was in bondage, or if not in bondage, then in servitude. It was just a few generations ago that women couldn't aspire to anything beyond caring for their children, the most noble thing you can do, but I want my daughters to be able to do other things, and they can do other things while still raising a family. It was just a few generations ago at a time when your grandmother, Harry, Her Majesty, was already an adult, when half the world was aflame and 60 million people were killed in a great global war. And when you think about the strides we've made in just my lifetime, I have some gray hair, but in the scale of human history, I'm a blink of an eye. You think about how much things have changed and gotten better. That has to make you optimistic. As long as you don't think that any of us can sit back passively and assume progress continues. History doesn't just run forwards, it runs backways and sideways, and it requires us to continually push. History doesn't just run forwards, it runs backways and sideways, and it requires us to continually push. Which brings those magi to mind again. Do we really need to get back on the camels in the dark again? Do we need to keep on pushing in the direction that our interpretation of events has compelled us to go? I can only imagine that characters in a story like that might have had moments of discouragement. They might have had seasons of despair. They might have had occasions for doubt or concern or open conflict with the members of their own party that thought that they had pushed long enough, that they had gone far enough in an ill-defined and indefensible direction, and that it was time to stop pushing. That history doesn't just run forward statement, you could understand that, of course, in many ways. I take it to primarily be a way of saying that the outcomes of the story are not foregone. That the essence of hope is to keep pushing toward new understandings, new and better outcomes, even when it's not exactly clear how things will go. We talked before Christmas about hope being something that we plant in a field of risk. To me, this feels analogous to that. And when I listened to the stories we were telling one another in community time, I think in particular about the story that Mike and Ariel talked about toward the end of that time. I think about organizations and institutions that how does an institution know something? That's a topic for another day. I was going to say institutions that know better, but wonder how to do better. Things that stop us from doing what we know are right, collectively and individually. That's the continually pushing part of this. Since this is a place in which we explore what we believe, and since as a community we stand in the Christian tradition at the same time that we are trying to act out what it looks like to evolve that tradition, I want to leave us today with an example of the sort of perspective, the kind of courageous imagination that it can take to keep on pushing even when the outcomes are unclear or when the path you choose isn't the typical one. And some of what it takes to face into that challenge. This is taken from a book called Mutiny by a writer named Kester Bruin. I came across it in a book by Pete Rollins called The Divine Magician, which I know I've both previously commended and continually acknowledge my own indebtedness to. This is a radical rereading of one of the best known and most beloved stories in the Bible, the story of the prodigal son. That story is, among other things, the narrative behind the icon on the table behind me. An important story in a variety of ways within a community like this. And typically, it's a story that's read as a story of repentance and love and grace and forgiveness. And that's certainly the way I've usually read it, and that's a reading of it that I have found deeply meaningful. Bruin, though, invites us to view it as a tragic tale of a failed revolution. And I think this reading has something quite profound to say, not just to those of us that have grown up familiar with the more common understanding of the story, but something uniquely potent to anyone that's wrestling with the story of colonialism, not least of all right here in our own country. So to start with, under Bruin's reading of this story, we have to take note that the family at the center of the narrative is a family of great wealth and privilege. When we are introduced to them, they don't know want, they don't know need, they're protected from many of the challenges of life because they own land, they own property, they own livestock, and given the cultural context, in all likelihood, they own people, they have slaves. The three characters in the story are the father, the grouchy older brother, who in that cultural context probably has very little social choice but to be a part of the family business, and the younger son. Now, the younger son, you know, like the famous one, the younger son sees that he has some sliver of hope at getting out from under the shadow of his father, and so he just dives headlong into this aggressive exploration of the world outside of his family. And as the narrative begins, this son asks his father for his share of the inheritance. We don't know from the story what motivates him. Maybe he wants to make his own way in the world. Maybe he wants to see what he can become if life isn't handed to him on a platter. Maybe he doesn't like the conservative way that wealth is handled by his family of origin. Maybe he sees a problem with the stockpiling for me and mine, and he wants to spend his share making new friends, seeing the world through his own eyes, having new experiences. Maybe he sees himself as a humanitarian figure. Maybe he sees himself as someone that's going to take his wealth to those in need. Whatever motivates him, it's not long before he finds himself in a very different world than the one that he grew up in. He encounters deep poverty. He encounters real need, not just as an idea, but firsthand. He learns what it's like to be really, really hungry. And he eventually ends up taking a job on a farm that pays so little that he covets the scraps that he's feeding to the pigs. The scene that came to my mind as I was reading this was an older movie already, Million Dollar Baby, but the scene in which Hilary Swank's poor boxing character is covertly sweeping the scraps off the table she's serving into a bag for her dog because she needs the protein. This moment in the story is the pivot of the narrative. One of my favorite and most evocative lines in all of sacred text is from this story. He came to his senses. Not going to chase that one today. The protagonist has a problem that needs to be solved. And on the face of it, it's not hard to see. He's poor, he's hungry, and he's working at a not quite survival job. That's not going to cut it. And so he comes up with a plan. And the story makes it clear that he knows that he can return to the wealth and privilege and comfort of his father's estate, but he's reluctant. He has some discomfort about going back to the old ways of living off the wealth of the family and being under the authority of his father. And so rather than return as a privileged son, he decides that he's going to return as a hired hand, and maybe that way he can do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. And so that's what he sets out to do. He's tired, he's hungry, he's gaunt, he's determined. He's going to do it. But it doesn't work out the way that he planned. Because his father, who has not ventured out into the world to look for his son, I think we should pause right there, because right now some of us have been tracking along fine, and that idea is the one that causes an uncomfortable level of cognitive dissonance, because that's not how the father behaves in this story, right? He's good. Stay with me if you can. I'm not telling you something that you need to accept or believe. I'm offering you a different reading for you to consider on its own merits in your own context. I think it's worth noting that the father's behavior in this parable is markedly different from the behavior of the main characters in similar parables about the lost sheep and the lost coin, in which both the shepherd and the woman launch aggressive searches for what's missing. In any case, back to our story. The father, who has stayed at home, surrounded by his cocoon of wealth and privilege, hears that his son is coming back. He's delighted. He runs out to greet him, welcome him back into the safety of the family home. And the son, who has this new way of thinking about wealth and integrity and work and the distribution of resources, starts to lay out his idea, and his father just shuts him down. He won't even entertain his son's ideas about working for him. He promptly drapes him in the garments of affluence. He gives him a family signet ring. He just draws him right back in. Of the son's experience under this reading, Bruin writes, "He was someone again, with a strange but alluring sense of power. This didn't seem to be the time or the place to challenge his father and persuade him to widen the radius of his generosity." And so, despite the poverty and the famine that surrounds the estate, a fattened calf is slaughtered and a feast is laid on so the family can celebrate in style. Read this way, this is a story about a failed revolution. It's a story about an idea whose time has come, that got pulled back by the collective gravity of what had gone before. By the, I think, easily understood allure of comfort and privilege and wealth and relative security. I don't think any of us in an honest moment would say these things are easy to step away from. No matter how bold the vision is, no matter what we think we've seen in our night sky. But if we were going to take this story the way that Bruin offers it to us, and we were going to sit it into our consideration of the story of the Magi, we might imagine that this is the moment where the youngest of that group of Magi, the one whose most radical reading of the night sky got everyone going on the quest in the first place, gives up. Yep, you guys are right. This is too much. It's time to hang it up. It's time to go back to Persia. It's time to go back to not sleeping on the ground. It's time to go back to a decent hot meal, to whatever other privileges go with being a prince of the realm. If this pushing is the price of an epiphany, I am not ready to pay it. That's a different story, isn't it? That's a hard reading of that story for lots of reasons. I think it also has something potentially very significant to say, well worth our time and consideration. I'm going to give it my time and consideration. One of the lovely things about this community is that if that consideration or exploration doesn't call out to you, then I would hope for the greatest sense of freedom to not be present to it. But I would also hope that you would hear a warm invitation to be present to it. We're going to keep pushing into this for a couple of weeks. So, I don't know the Latin phrase, but it translates forewarned, forearmed. All right? Peace.